President Rob, fellow members and guests. It's my pleasure today to introduce Professor Susan Davis, who doesn't need a lot of introduction because she is, of course, a member. She's the director of the Women's Health Research Program in the School of Public Health and Preventive Medicine of Monash University, and she's presently the president of the International Menopause Society. Peter Rogers has also pointed out to me that Susan is a tremendous help on the district committee of the Australian Rotary Health. So she's doing a lot for Rotary. Her topic today is inequitable equity, which she will explain a bit further. I should also point out she's a world leader in endocrinology, and I'm very anxious to hear what endocrinology actually means. So please welcome Susan.
So good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for that introduction. It's a real honour and a pleasure to speak to you all regarding women's issues and really with forthcoming International Women's Day. I'm an endocrinologist, to the relief of many. I'm not a gynecologist. And an endocrinologist is someone who specialises in hormones. My expertise is in fact in sex steroids, but I'm not going to talk about medicine and I'm not going to talk about women's health. I'm going to talk about inequitable equity. I'm going to talk about where we've come from, where we are, and where we're going. So what do I mean by this? Well, in 1948, the UN General Assembly adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This was about the right to life, dignity, equity, liberty. Actually, they use the word brotherhood, but I've left that out. Prohibition of slavery and prohibition of torture. In 1952, the UN General Assembly approved the Convention of the Political Rights of Women. This was the first internationally adopted manifesto that codified the rights of women to vote, hold political office, and to politically empower women. It wasn't until 1979 that the UN General Assembly adopted the Convention of the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. This document had 30 articles, was 30 years in the making. It covers social, sexual, and political rights, and it's the founding document for several declarations and conventions. 1981, it was ratified by 20 countries. Australia ratified it in 1983, and by 1989, it was ratified by 100 countries. So therefore, as George Bush would say, mission accomplished. But no, that's where we've come from. Where are we now? So in 2006, the World Economic Forum established what they called the Gender Index. And this benchmarks gender parity across the world, across 149 countries for which there's sufficient information. There are four key determinants, and these include parity in educational attainment, health and survival, economic participation, which includes participation, remuneration, and advancement, and political empowerment, which is the number of women versus men in leadership political positions. Now, it might surprise you that globally, the disparity in education and health survival between the genders is only 4%. That means women and men are equally achieving pretty well education and health. Globally, 65% of men and women are in secondary school and 35% in tertiary education. That's pretty good. The gap in economic participation is 44%. And in 29 of the 149 countries, for which it's only 29 for which data is available, do I surprise you by telling you that women spend twice as much time as men in unpaid activities, particularly domestic duties? In terms of opportunity, they focused in the 2018 report on workforce opportunities, and one of the biggest gaps is in IT. Within the emerging area of artificial intelligence, the gender gap is almost 80%. Now, it would not surprise people that the gap in political empowerment is the greatest, 77% globally between men and women. Men hold the power. Across all four key elements, again, I think everybody in this room could probably name the most powerous countries, the countries with the greatest parity. Iceland, top of the pops, Norway, Sweden, and Finland. But even Iceland has a political empowerment gap of 33% between the genders. Only 17 of 149 countries have a female head of state. Less than 20% of countries across the world have government ministers who are female. 24% of parliamentarians globally are women. And 34% of managerial positions are women. I don't think anyone in this room would be able to get the answer correct on the top four countries with almost achieving, well, the greatest parity in political empowerment. These are the Bahamas, Colombia, Jamaica, Laos, and the Philippines. That's where women hold the greatest political empowerment. What about us? Well, Australia is ranked 39th in 149 countries, and we are falling down the ladder. We have fallen back in wage parity and in political empowerment. We're not going up. On a rating scale of 0 to 1, Australia, in terms of political empowerment, ranks at 0.23. Pretty low. Women constitute 29% of the House of Representatives and 30% of the Federal Senate. How does it break down? 1 out of 16 National Party representatives in the House are women, 12 out of 60 Liberal Party members are women, and 28 out of 70 Labor Party members are women. It's estimated it's going to take us 108 years before we reach parity in political empowerment. And the 2017 report and the 18 reports say it's a backward trend. So the point is, I can go on with statistics, but why has this happened? Why are we not achieving parity? And it's not because we don't have enough creches. Girls outperform boys at school. So why do girls not progress? And I reflected on my own appointment. I'm what's called a Senior Principal Research Fellow of the NHMRC, which is the highest level you can attain in NHMRC funding as a fellow. When you look at the ranks, the first level, Senior Research Fellows, which is like an associate professor, 37% are female. Principal Research Fellows, 25% are female. Senior Principal Research Fellows, which is what I am, only 1 in 7, 14% are female. Why does this happen? Well, firstly, there's a whole literature on it. Women generally hold back. They do not self-promote. They do not apply for promotion until they're overqualified, whereas men tend to put up their hands when they're underprepared and underqualified. What evidence do I have for this? LinkedIn did a review of 141 million memberships on LinkedIn. Men skew their professional brands to highlight more senior level experience and often remove their junior qualifications. And on average, women share 11% fewer skills on their page than men, even though they have the skills. Men are known to negotiate higher starting salaries than women. And in most professions, as you know, for equal parity of work, are higher paid. There are conflicting expectations for women as leaders. Women are expected to be demanding and tough, and concurrently caring and considerate and sharing. The work schedules remain family unfriendly. Schedules tend to start at 8 and finish at 6. I've always refused to do 8 o'clock meetings and 6 o'clock meetings, but that means I don't get to play ball with the fellas. And then you can take a quote from Rex Harrison in My Fair Lady. Why can't a woman be more like a man? And that's the problem with this is the programs for advancing women are about fixing women to be more like men. The programs tell us to adopt more powerful postures, to lean in when we talk, not to make the tea, to negotiate more powerfully, to be assertive, and to talk more at meetings. These programs epitomize and actually value gender bias. They tell us that male behavior is more valued and is the way to success. But the problem is when women adopt maleness, they're often denigrated in their position because it's not considered the right thing for a woman to be tough and self-advocate. In their booking Through the Labyrinth, Egli and Carly wrote, "Self-promoting women risk having less influence than women who are more modest, even though women who self-promote are considered more competent." And going across the industries, there's actually evidence that women are, dare I say, more punished in their roles than men. There was a co-authored paper from the Harvard, Stanford, and Macomb School of Business in 2018, published. And this paper summarized a review of 1.2 million registered US financial advisors. And what's unique about the financial industry is you can look at misdemeanors across the industry because they're reportable. And when they looked at the financial industry, they looked at where any misconduct had occurred. And they were able to report this in great detail. Across the board, women had lower incidence of misconduct. And when misconduct had occurred, it was less serious than any misconduct done by men. But, interestingly, after any incident of misconduct, women were 20% more likely to be dismissed and 30% less likely to be re-employed in their vocation. What was also interesting, the gap correlated with the gender composition of the management team. So if you had more men on the management team, women were more likely to be more severely disciplined. Then the other issue is that in addition to the role modelling of what a leader should be, the actual paradigm of senior leadership positions are modelled to the traditional view of what a male leader should be. It's not even the view that most men, or the traditional role that a lot of men would even want to take up today. So a paper was published in the medical journal The Lancet this year. In fact, The Lancet devoted a whole issue to women in medicine. And Dr. Ria Liang from Australia investigated why women leave surgical training. In the UK and Australia, only 11% of surgeons are women, even today. Not surprisingly, the issues were long working hours and unpredictable schedules, resulting in fatigue and sleep deprivation. Lack of support for parenting, notably even from senior surgeons, were unlikely to support their junior female surgical trainees with parenting leave. Insufficient role models for the young women because there weren't many women leaders ahead of them, and sexism. And one of the interviewees in this for this publication, and it doesn't surprise me, said, "If a male surgeon raises his voice in the operating theatre because something he wanted wasn't there, the nurses would quickly try to help. If a female surgeon did likewise, the backlash would be team room talk by the nurses about how badly she had behaved." Unfortunately, still in our surgical training program, there is sexual harassment and fear. And this has been investigated heavily in the last 2 years, and there have been problems identified. But bullying and harassment is not limited to medicine and surgical trainees. In fact, in 2018, there was a report of the Australian Border Force. Women were found to experience unacceptable levels of bullying and harassment, unconscious bias through informal networks, and discriminatory practices were disproportionately being meted out towards women. And finally, why aren't women succeeding? Because women are time poor. In the early 70s, many of you in this room will remember there was the boiler case, because prior to the case, if a woman was an airline hostess, she was forced to resign if she turned 28, because after that she was an old boiler, or if she married. Up until 1979, women were sacked from the Commonwealth Public Service if they got married or fell pregnant. In 1979, 45% of women aged 45 to 54 years were in paid employment. Now it's 80%. So women, at a time that they're achieving perhaps seniority in their professions, they're achieving it at a time when they often have teenage children or elderly parents. And they're squeezed between generations, when they literally have responsibilities that override their ability to go up the food chain in the workforce. The cost to women in leadership is the cost of choosing to have a family and working out how to deal with time poverty. It's not an issue, as I said, that's going to simply be fixed by building more creches. Women in my situation have had to take time out for parenting. And I remember being told that there was a hole in my CV. And I said, no, there's no hole. I had 4 children. No, you haven't published for the last 10 years. So you can imagine how fast I had to pedal up the hill to get up the ladder. But where are we going? What about the next generation? They believe in freedom and opportunity. Well, Gen Y is the generation born between 79 and 88. So after the abolition of discriminatory practices of having to stop work when you're pregnant or married. The average age for a woman to have a child in Australia now is 30. So women in their early 50s are still having young children living at home. 20% of Generation Y will never have children. That's a huge demographic shift to what we have now. And those that do will be delaying childbirth. I see a lot of women in their 40s who are having children. That means in their 50s, they'll have 10-year-olds and 12-year-olds. It's very hard to be in a senior position when you've got to get home to the homework and do the run around after school. Increasingly also, these next generation are going to be more sandwiched than our generation between young children and elderly parents, and even managing time to look after their own health. So these are the problems. What are we going to do about it? Well, we have to have systemic change in behavior and beliefs. Firstly, we have to recognize the issues. Secondly, we have to value female attributes, not devalue them. We don't fix women by making them behave like men. We value the attributes of women. We also create senior leadership positions that women want to have. Women don't want jobs where they have to be there at 7:30 or 8 in the morning and not be there when their kids go to school, or be at meetings at 6 o'clock at night and not be there to prepare dinner at home. They actually like those. Many women like doing those things. Many men like doing those things, and that's why we're actually seeing an exodus of young people from leadership or promotion positions. We all know many young people who don't want to progress in the rat race of peddling continuously to keep up, because that's the only way to succeed. So we have to make more humane work conditions for people who move up and accelerate up the food chain. We have to have a top-down cultural change. So our leaders have to actually demonstrate the attributes we want future leaders to have. And we have to have leadership behavior that influences the change throughout the community. An example I can give of this is, there is a guy who is Chris and I both know, who's head of Aspen Snowmass ski lifts and the whole mountain. He is the nicest man. We sat with him next to him on a plane once, and he said, anytime you want to ask me something, email me. About a year later, I emailed him, and he remembered, and he answered my email. And he's in charge of thousands of people and a multi-million dollar establishment. And everybody pretty well who works on Aspen Snowmass looks up to this guy because he shows really wonderful, humane, kind, considerate approaches to the whole top-down management of his organization. We need to understand how bias works and dismiss the self-belief that we are not biased. We all judge people about how they appear, how they behave, how they're dressed. In 20 seconds, we sum up someone when we meet them about how they appear in their body language and their clothing. And unfortunately, women are more harshly judged than men. And we all have to reflect on our biases and try to improve our behavior by acknowledging our biases. We need mentoring programs, not just mandatory diversity training, which I have to do and tick off boxes. We need gender-balanced interview committees, management teams, and employment teams, boards, and political systems. And we need organizational accountability and transparency. So tragically, Australia is lagging behind. We think we're a very democratic country. But in fact, the global index shows that we're slipping back and not performing as well as we should be performing. I think that it's going to take 106 years before we can bridge the gender gap is really a sad assessment of where we're at, and that we can do better. And by reviewing how we behave, our own workplaces, and how we can perhaps influence change as individuals is really important. So I'll leave that with you for food for thought for International Women's Day. So thank you.